But I say, my boy, maybe it will go into a second edition. Then there'll be money again,
And can you really have got so much money for it, Ivan Petrovich?
Observed Anna Andreevna.
I look at you and somehow can't believe it. Mercy on us, what people will give money for nowadays?
You know, Vanya, said the old man, more and more carried away by enthusiasm. It's a career, though it's not the service. Even the highest in the land will read it. Here you tell me Gogol receives a yearly allowance and was sent abroad. What if it were the same with you, eh? Or is it too soon? Must you write something more? Then write it, my boy. Write it as quick as possible. Don't rest on your laurels. What hinders you?
And he said this with such an air of conviction, with such good nature, that I could not pluck up resolution to stop him and throw cold water on his fancies.
Or they may be giving you a snuff-box directly, mayn't they? Why not? They want to encourage you. And who knows, maybe you'll be presented at court,
he added in a half-whisper, screwing up his left eye with a significant air.
Or not. Is it too soon for the court?
The court, indeed,
said Anna Andreevna with an offended air. In another minute you'll be making me a general, I answered, laughing heartily. The old man laughed too. He was exceedingly pleased.
Your Excellency, won't you have something to eat?
Cried Natasha playfully. She had meantime been getting supper for us. She laughed, ran to her father, and flung her warm arms round him.
Dear kind daddy!
The old man was moved.
Well, well, that's all right. I speak in the simplicity of my heart. General or no general, come to supper. Ah, you sentimental girl,
he added, patting his Natasha on her flushed cheek, as he was fond of doing on every convenient occasion.
I spoke because I love you, Vanya, you know. But even if not a general, far from it, you're a distinguished man, an author.
Nowadays, Daddy, they call them writers.
Not authors. I didn't know. Well, let it be writers, then, but I tell you what I wanted to say. People are not made Kammerherrs, of course, because they write novels. It's no use to dream of that. But anyway, you can make your mark. Become an attaché of some sort. They may send you abroad, to Italy, for the sake of your health, or somewhere to perfect yourself in your studies. You'll be helped with money. Of course, it must all be honourable on your side. You must get money and honour by work, by real good work, and not through patronage of one sort or another.
And don't you be too proud, then, Ivan Petrovich,
added Anna Andreevna, laughing.
You'd better give him a star at once, Daddy. After all, what's the good of an attaché?
And she pinched my arm again.
This girl keeps making fun of me,
said the old man, looking delightedly at Natasha, whose cheeks were glowing and whose eyes were shining like stars.
I think I really may have overshot the mark, children, but I've always been like that. But do you know, Vanya, I keep wondering at you. How perfectly simple you are.
Why, good heavens, Daddy, what else could he be?
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. Only, Vanya, you've a face that's not what one would call a poet's. They're pale, they say, you know, the poets, and with hair like this, you know, and a look in their eyes. Like Goethe, you know, and the rest of them. I've read that in Abaddon. Well, have I put my foot in it again? Ah, the rogue, she's giggling at me. I'm not a scholar, my dears, but I can feel. Well, face or no face, that's no great matter. Yours is all right for me, and I like it very much. I didn't mean that. Only, be honest, Vanya, be honest. That's the great thing. Live honestly. Don't be conceited. The road lies open before you. Serve your work honestly. That's what I meant to say. Yes, that's just what I wanted to say.
It was a wonderful time. Every evening, every free hour I spent with them. I brought the old man news of the literary world and of writers, in whom he began, I don't know why, to take an intense interest. He even began to read the critical articles of B, about whom I talked a great deal. He praised him enthusiastically, though he scarcely understood him, and inveighed against his enemies who wrote in the Northern Drone. Anna Andreevna kept a sharp eye on me and Natasha, but she didn't see everything. One little word had been uttered between us already, and I heard at last Natasha, with her little head drooping and her lips half parted, whisper yes. But the parents knew of it later on. They had their thoughts, their conjectures. Anna Andreevna shook her head for a long time. It seemed strange and dreadful to her. She had no faith in me.
Yes, it's all right, of course, when it's successful, Ivan Petrovich,
she said.
But all of a sudden there'll be a failure or something of the sort. And what then? If only you had a post somewhere.
I've something I want to say to you, Vanya, said the old man, making up his mind. I've seen for myself, I've noticed it, and I confess, I'm delighted that you and Natasha, you know what I mean. You see, Vanya, you're both very young, and my Anna Andreevna is right. Let us wait a bit. Granted, you have talent, remarkable talent, perhaps. Not genius, as they cried about you at first, but simply talent. I read you that article in the Drone today. They handle you too roughly, but after all, it's not much of a paper. Yes, you see, talent's not money in the bank, and you're both poor. Let's wait a little, for a year and a half, or a year, anyway. If you get on all right, get a firm footing, Natasha shall be yours. If you don't get on, judge for yourself. You're an honest man, think things over.
And so we left it. And this is what happened within the year. Yes, it was almost exactly a year ago. One bright September day I went to see my old friends, feeling ill and sick at heart, and sank on a chair almost fainting, so that they were actually frightened as they looked at me. My head went round and my heart ached so that 10 times I had approached the door and 10 times I had turned back before I went in. But it was not because I had failed in my career and had neither renown nor money. It was not because I was not yet an attaché and nowhere near being sent to Italy for my health. It was because one may live through 10 years in 1 year, and my Natasha had lived through 10 years in that year. Infinity lay between us. And I remember I sat there before the old man, saying nothing, with unconscious fingers tearing the brim of my hat, which was torn already. I sat and, I don't know why, waited for Natasha to come in. My clothes were shabby and did not fit me. I had grown thin, yellow, and sunken in the face. And yet I did not look in the least like a poet, and there was none of that grandeur in my eyes about which good Nikolai Sergeyitch had been so concerned in the past. Anna Andreevna looked at me with unfeigned and ever-ready compassion, thinking to herself,
"And he was within an ace of being betrothed to Natasha. Lord, have mercy on us and preserve us. Won't you have some tea, Ivan Petrovitch?"
The samovar was boiling on the table.
"How are you getting on?"
she asked me.
"You're quite an invalid,"
she said in a plaintive voice, which I can hear at this moment. And I can see her as though it were today. Even while she talked to me, her eyes betrayed another anxiety, the same anxiety which clouded the face of her old husband, too, as he sat, now brooding, while his tea grew cold. I knew that they were terribly worried at this moment over their lawsuit with Prince Valkovsky, which was not promising well for them, and that they had had other new worries which had upset Nikolai Sergeyitch and made him ill. The young prince, about whom the whole trouble that led to the lawsuit had arisen, had found an opportunity of visiting the Ichmenyevs 5 months before. The old man, who loved his dear Alyosha like a son and spoke of him almost every day, welcomed him joyfully. Anna Andreevna recalled Vasilyevsko and shed tears. Alyosha went to see them more and more frequently without his father's knowledge. Nikolai Sergeyitch, with his honesty, openness, and uprightness, indignantly disdained all precautions. His honourable pride forbade his even considering what the prince would say if he knew that his son inwardly despised all his absurd suspicions and was received again in the house of the Ichmenyevs. But the old man did not know whether he would have the strength to endure fresh insults. The young prince began to visit them almost daily. The parents enjoyed having him. He used to stay with them the whole evening, long after midnight. His father, of course, heard of all this at last. An abominable scandal followed. He insulted Nikolai Sergeyitch with a horrible letter, taking the same line as before, and peremptorily forbade his son to visit the house. This had happened just a fortnight before I came to them that day. The old man was terribly depressed. Was his Natasha, his innocent, noble girl, to be mixed up in this dirty slander, this vileness again? Her name had been insultingly uttered before by the man who had injured him, and was all this to be left unavenged? For the first few days he took to his bed in despair. All that I knew. The story had reached me in every detail, though for the last 3 weeks I had been lying ill and despondent at my lodging, and had not been to see them. But I knew besides. No, at that time I only felt what was coming. I knew but could not believe that, apart from these worries, there was something which must trouble them beyond anything in the world, and I looked at them with torturing anguish. Yes, I was in torture. I was afraid to conjecture, afraid to believe, and did all I could to put off the fatal moment. And meanwhile I had come on account of it. I felt drawn to them that evening.
"Yes, Vanya,"
the old man began, suddenly rousing himself.
"Surely you have not been ill. Why haven't you been here for so long? I have behaved badly to you. I have been meaning ever so long to call on you, but somehow it's all been—"
And he sank into brooding again. "I haven't been well," I answered.
"Hmm, not well,"
he repeated 5 minutes later.
"I dare say not. I talked to you and warned you before, but you wouldn't heed me. Hmm. No, Vanya, my boy, the muse has lived hungry in a garret from time immemorial, and she'll go on so. That's what it is."
Yes, the old man was out of spirits. If he had not had a sore heart himself, he would not have talked to me of the hungry muse. I looked intently at his face. It was sallower. There was a look of bewilderment in his eyes, some idea in the form of a question which he had not the strength to answer. He was abrupt and bitter, quite unlike himself. His wife looked at this uneasily and shook her head. When he turned away, she stealthily nodded to me. "How is Natalia Nikolaevna? Is she at home?" I inquired of the anxious lady.
"She's at home, my dear man. She's at home,"
she answered, as though perturbed by my question.
"She'll come in to see you directly. It's a serious matter. Not a sight of you for 3 weeks, and she's become so queer. There's no making her out at all. I don't know whether she's well or ill, God bless her."
And she looked timidly at her husband.
"Why, there's nothing wrong with her,"
Nikolai Sergeyitch responded jerkily and reluctantly.
"She's quite well. The girl's beginning to grow up. She's left off being a baby, that's all. Who can understand girlish moods and caprices?"
"Caprices, indeed,"
Anna Andreevna caught him up in an offended voice. The old man said nothing and drummed on the table with his fingertips. "Good God, is there something between them already?" I wondered in a panic.
"Well, how are you getting on?"
he began again.
"Is B still writing reviews?"
"Yes," I answered.
"Ech, Vanya, Vanya,"
he ended up with a wave of his hand.
"What can reviews do now?"
The door opened and Natasha walked in. Chapter 7. She held her hat in her hand and laid it down on the piano. Then she came up to me and held out her hand without speaking. Her lips faintly quivered as though she wanted to utter something, some greeting to me, but she said nothing. It was 3 weeks since we had seen each other. I looked at her with amazement and dread. How she had changed in those 3 weeks. My heart ached as I looked at those pale, hollow cheeks, feverishly parched lips, and eyes that gleamed under the long dark lashes with a feverish fire and a sort of passionate determination. But, my God, how lovely she was! Never before or since have I seen her as she was on that fateful day. Was it the same Natasha, the same girl who only a year ago had listened to my novel with her eyes fixed on me and her lips following mine, who had so gaily and carelessly laughed and jested with her father and me at supper afterwards? Was it the same Natasha who in that very room had said yes to me, hanging her head and flushing all over? We heard the deep note of the bell ringing for vespers. She started. Anna Andreevna crossed herself.
"You're ready for church, Natasha, and they're ringing for the service. Go, Natasha, go and pray. It's a good thing it's so near. And you'll get a walk, too, at the same time. Why sit shut up indoors? See how pale you are, as though you were bewitched. Perhaps I won't go today,"
said Natasha slowly, in a low voice, almost a whisper.
"I'm not well,"
she added, and turned white as a sheet.
"You'd better go, Natasha. You wanted to just now, and fetched your hat. Pray, Natasha, pray that God may give you good health,"
Anna Andreevna persuaded her daughter, looking timidly at her as though she were afraid of her.
"Yes, go, and it will be a walk for you, too,"
the old man added, and he, too, looked uneasily at his daughter.
"Mother is right. Here, Vanya will escort you."
I fancied that Natasha's lips curled in a bitter smile. She went to the piano, picked up her hat, and put it on. Her hands were trembling. All her movements seemed, as it were, unconscious, as though she did not know what she were doing. Her father and mother watched her attentively.
"Goodbye,"
she said, hardly audibly.
"My angel, why goodbye? Is it so far away? A blow in the wind will do you good. See how pale you are. Ah, I forgot. I forget everything. I finished the scapular for you. There's a prayer sewn into it, my angel. A nun from Kiev taught it to me last year. A very suitable prayer. I sewed it in just now. Put it on, Natasha. Maybe God will send you good health. You are all we have.
And the mother took out of her work drawer a golden cross that Natasha wore round her neck. On the same ribbon was hung a scapular she had just finished.
May it bring you health,
she added, crossing her daughter and putting the cross on.
At one time I used to bless you every night before you slept, and said a prayer, and you repeated it after me. But now you're not the same, and God does not vouchsafe you a quiet spirit. Ach, Natasha, Natasha, your mother's prayer is no help to you.
And the mother began crying. Natasha kissed her mother's hand without speaking and took a step towards the door. But suddenly she turned quickly back and went up to her father. Her bosom heaved.
Daddy, you crossed your daughter too,
she brought out in a gasping voice, and she sank on her knees before him. We were all perplexed at this unexpected and too solemn action. For a few seconds her father looked at her quite at a loss.
Natasha, my little one, my girl, my darling, what's the matter with you?
He cried at last, and tears streamed from his eyes.
Why are you grieving? Why are you crying day and night? I see it all, you know. I don't sleep at night, but stand and listen at your door. Tell me everything, Natasha. Tell me all about it. I'm old, and we...
He did not finish. He raised her and embraced her and held her close. She pressed convulsively against his breast and hid her head on his shoulder.
It's nothing, nothing. It's only... I'm not well,
she kept repeating, choking with suppressed tears.
May God bless you as I bless you, my darling child, my precious child,
said the father.
May he send you peace of heart forever, and protect you from all sorrow. Pray to God, my love, that my sinful prayer may reach him.
And my blessing too, is upon you,
added the mother, dissolving into tears.
Goodbye,
whispered Natasha. At the door she stood still again, took one more look at them, tried to say something more, but could not, and went quickly out of the room. I rushed after her with a foreboding of evil. Chapter 8. She walked with her head down, rapidly, in silence, without looking at me. But as she came out of the street onto the embankment, she stopped short and took my arm.
I'm stifling,
she whispered.
My heart grips me. I'm stifling.
Come back, Natasha, I cried in alarm.
Surely you must have seen, Vanya, that I've gone away forever, left them forever, and shall never go back,
she said, looking at me with inexpressible anguish. My heart sank. I had foreseen all this on my way to them. I had seen it all, as it were, in a mist, long before that day, perhaps. Yet now her words fell upon me like a thunderbolt. We walked miserably along the embankment. I could not speak. I was reflecting, trying to think, and utterly at a loss. My heart was in a whirl. It seemed so hideous, so impossible.
You blame me, Vanya,
she said at last. No, but I can't believe it. It cannot be, I answered, not knowing what I was saying.
Yes, Vanya, it really is so. I have gone away from them, and I don't know what will become of them, or what will become of me.
You're going to him, Natasha, yes?
Yes,
she answered. But that's impossible, I cried frantically. Don't you understand that it's impossible, Natasha? My poor girl! Why, it's madness! Why, you'll kill them and ruin yourself! You understand that, Natasha?
I know, but what am I to do? I can't help it,
she said, and her voice was as full of anguish as though she were facing the scaffold. Come back before it's too late, I besought her. And the more warmly, the more emphatically I implored her, the more I realized the uselessness of my entreaties, and the absurdity of them at that moment. Do you understand, Natasha, what you are doing to your father? Have you thought of that? You know his father is your father's enemy. Why, the prince has insulted your father, has accused him of stealing money. Why, he called him a thief. You know why they've gone to law with one another. Good heavens, and that's not the worst. Do you know, Natasha? Oh, God, of course you know it all. Do you know that the prince suspected your father and mother of having thrown you and Alyosha together on purpose, when Alyosha was staying in the country with you? Think a minute. Only fancy what your father went through then, owing to that slander. Why, his hair has turned grey in these 2 years. Look at him. And what's more, you know all this, Natasha. Good heavens, to say nothing of what it will mean to them both to lose you forever. Why, you're their treasure, all that is left them in their old age. I don't want to speak of that. You must know it for yourself. Remember that your father thinks you've been slandered without cause, insulted by these snobs, unavenged. And now, at this very time, it's all flared up again. All this old rankling enmity has grown more bitter than ever because you have received Alyosha. The prince has insulted your father again. The old man's anger is still hot at this fresh affront, and suddenly now all these accusations will turn out to be true. Everyone who knows about it will justify the prince now, and throw the blame on you and your father. Why, what will become of him now? It will kill him outright. Shame, disgrace, and through whom? Through you, his daughter, his one precious child. And your mother? Why, she won't outlive your old father, you know. Natasha, Natasha, what are you about? Turn back. Think what you are doing. She did not speak. At last she glanced at me, as it were, reproachfully. And there was such piercing anguish, such suffering in her eyes, that I saw that apart from my words, her wounded heart was bleeding already. I saw what her decision was costing her, and how I was torturing her, lacerating her with my useless words that came too late. I saw all that, and yet I could not restrain myself, and went on speaking. Why, you said yourself just now to Anna Andreevna that perhaps you would not go out of the house, to the service. So you meant to stay. So you are still hesitating. She only smiled bitterly in reply. And why did I ask that? I might have understood that all was irrevocably settled. But I was beside myself, too. Can you love him so much? I cried, looking at her with a sinking at the heart, scarcely knowing what I was asking.
What can I say to you, Vanya? You see, he told me to come, and here I am waiting for him,
she said with the same bitter smile. But listen, only listen, I began again, catching at a straw. This can all be arranged differently, quite differently. You need not go away from the house. I'll tell you how to manage, Natasha. I'll undertake to arrange it all for you, meetings and everything. Only don't leave home. I will carry your letters. Why not? It would be better than what you're doing. I know how to arrange it. I'll do anything for both of you. You'll see. And then you won't ruin yourself, Natasha dear, as you're doing. For you'll ruin yourself hopelessly as it is, hopelessly. Only agree, Natasha, and everything will go well and happily, and you can love each other as much as you like. And when your fathers have left off quarrelling, for they're bound to leave off some day, then...
Enough, Vanya, stop,
she interrupted, pressing my hand tightly and smiling through her tears.
Dear, kind Vanya, you're a good, honourable man, and not one word of yourself. I've deserted you, and you forgive everything. You think of nothing but my happiness. You are ready to carry letters for us.
She burst into tears.
I know how you loved me, Vanya, and how you love me still. And you've not reproached me with one bitter word all this time, while I, how badly I've treated you. Do you remember, Vanya? Do you remember our time together? It would have been better if I'd never met him, never seen him. I could have lived with you, dear, kind Vanya, my dear one. No, I'm not worthy of you. You see what I am. At such a minute, I remind you of our past happiness, though you were wretched enough without that. Here you've not been to see us for 3 weeks. I swear to you, Vanya, the thought never once entered my head that you hated me and had cursed me. I knew why you did not come. You did not want to be in our way and to be a living reproach to us. And wouldn't it have been painful for you to see us? And how I've missed you, Vanya. How I've missed you, Vanya. Listen, if I love Alyosha madly, insanely, yet perhaps I love you even more as a friend. I feel, I know that I couldn't go on living without you. I need you. I need your soul, your heart of gold. Oh, Vanya, what a bitter, terrible time is before us.
She burst into a flood of tears. Yes, she was very wretched.
Oh, how I've been longing to see you,
she went on, mastering her tears.
How thin you've grown, how ill and pale you are. You really have been ill, haven't you, Vanya? And I haven't even asked. I keep talking of myself. How are you getting on with the reviewers now? What about your new novel? Is it going well?
As though we could talk about novels. As though we could talk about me now, Natasha. As though my work mattered. That's all right. Let it be. But tell me, Natasha, did he insist himself that you should go to him?
No, not only he. It was more I. He did say so, certainly, but I too. You see, dear, I'll tell you everything. They're making a match for him with a very rich girl of very high rank, and related to very grand people. His father absolutely insists on his marrying her, and his father, as you know, is an awful schemer. He sets every spring working, and it's a chance that wouldn't come once in 10 years. Connections, money, and they say she's very pretty, and she has education, a good heart, everything good. Alyosha's attracted by her already, and what's more, his father's very anxious to get it over, so as to get married himself. And so he's determined to break it off between us. He's afraid of me and my influence on Alyosha.
But you mean to say that the prince knows of your love? I interrupted in surprise. Surely he only suspects it, and is not at all sure of it.
He knows it. He knows all about it.
Why? Who told him?
Alyosha told him everything a little while ago. He told me himself that he had told him all about it.
Good God! What is going on? He tells all this himself, and at such a time!
Don't blame him, Vanya.
Natasha broke in.
Don't jeer at him. He can't be judged like other people. Be fair. He's not like you and me. He's a child. He's not been properly brought up. He doesn't understand what he's doing. The first impression, the influence of the first person he meets, can turn him away from what he has promised a minute before. He has no character. He'll vow to be true to you, and that very day he will just as truthfully, just as sincerely, devote himself to someone else. And what's more, he'll be the first person to come and tell you about it. He may do something bad, but yet one can't blame him for it, but can only feel sorry for him. He's even capable of self-sacrifice, and if you knew what sacrifice, but only till the next new impression, then he'll forget it all. So he'll forget me if I'm not continually with him. That's what he's like.
Ach, Natasha, but perhaps that's all not true. That's only gossip. How can a boy like that get married?
I tell you, his father has special objects of his own.
But how do you know that this young lady is so charming, and that he is already attracted by her?
Why, he told me so himself.
What? Told you himself that he might love another woman, and demands this sacrifice from you now?
No, Vanya, no. You don't know him. You've not been much with him. You must know him better before you judge of him. There isn't a truer and purer heart than his in the world. Why, would it be better if he were to be? And as for his being attracted by her, why, if he didn't see me for a week, he'd fall in love with someone else and forget me, and then, when he saw me, he'd be at my feet again. No, it's a good thing I know it, that it's not concealed from me, or else I should be dying of suspicion. Yes, Vanya, I have come to the conclusion, if I'm not always with him, continually, every minute, he will cease to love me, forget me, and give me up. He's like that. Any other woman can attract him. And then what should I do? I should die. Die, indeed. I should be glad to die now. But what will it be for me to live without him? That would be worse than death itself, worse than any agony. Oh, Vanya, Vanya, it does mean something that I've abandoned my father and mother for him. Don't try and persuade me. Everything's decided. He must be near me every hour, every minute. I can't go back. I know that I'm ruined and that I'm ruining others. Oh, Vanya!
She cried suddenly and began trembling all over.
What if he doesn't love me even now? What if it's true what you said of him just now?
I had never said it.
That he's only deceiving me, that he only seems to be so truthful and sincere, and is really wicked and vain. I'm defending him to you now, and perhaps this very minute he's laughing at me with another woman. And I'm so abject that I've thrown up everything, and am walking about the streets looking for him. Oh, Vanya!
This moan broke with such anguish from her heart that my whole soul filled with grief. I realized that Natasha had lost all control of herself. Only a blind, insane, intense jealousy could have brought her to this frantic resolution. But jealousy flamed up in my heart too, and suddenly burst out. I could not restrain myself. A horrid feeling drew me on. Natasha, I said, there's only one thing I don't understand. How can you love him after what you've just said about him yourself? You don't respect him, you don't even believe in his love, and you're going to him irrevocably, and are ruining everyone for his sake. What's the meaning of it? He'll torture you so as to spoil your whole life. Yes, and you, his, too. You love him too much, Natasha, too much. I don't understand such love.
Yes, I love him as though I were mad,
she answered, turning pale as though in bodily pain.
I never loved you like that, Vanya. I know, I've gone out of my mind, and I don't love him as I ought to. I don't love him in the right way. Listen, Vanya, I knew beforehand, and even in our happiest moments I felt that he would bring me nothing but misery. But what is to be done if even torture from him is happiness to me now? Do you suppose I'm going to him to meet joy? Do you suppose I don't know beforehand what's in store for me, or what I shall have to bear from him? Why, he'd sworn to love me, made all sorts of promises, but I don't trust one of his promises. I don't set any value on them, and I never have, though I knew he wasn't lying to me, and can't lie. I told him myself, that I don't want to bind him in any way. That's better with him. No one likes to be tied, I less than any. And yet I'm glad to be his slave, his willing slave, to put up with anything from him, anything so long as he is with me, so long as I can look at him. I think he might even love another woman, if only I were there, if only I might be near. Isn't it abject, Vanya?
She asked, suddenly looking at me with a sort of feverish, haggard look. For one instant it seemed to me she was delirious.
Isn't it abject, such a wish? What if it is? I say that it is abject myself. Yet, if he were to abandon me, I should run after him to the ends of the earth, even if he were to repulse me, even if he were to drive me away. You try to persuade me to go back, but what use is that? If I went back, I should come away tomorrow. He would tell me to, and I should come. He would call, would whistle to me like a dog, and I should run to him. Torture. I don't shrink away from any torture from him. I should know it was at his hands I was suffering. Oh, there's no telling it, Vanya.
And her father and mother, I thought. She seemed to have already forgotten them. Then he's not going to marry you, Natasha.
He's promised to. He's promised everything. It's for that he's sent for me now, to be married tomorrow, secretly, out of town. But you see, he doesn't know what he's doing. Very likely he doesn't know how one gets married. And what a husband! It's absurd, really. And if he does get married, he won't be happy. He'll begin to reproach me. I don't want him to reproach me with anything, ever. I'll give up everything for him, and let him do nothing for me. If he's going to be unhappy from being married, why make him unhappy?
Yes, this is a sort of frenzy, Natasha, said I. Well, are you going straight to him now?
No, he promised to come here to fetch me. We agreed.
And she looked eagerly into the distance, but as yet there was no one. And he's not here yet. And you've come first, I cried with indignation. Natasha staggered as though from a blow. Her face worked convulsively.
He may not come at all,
she said with bitter mockery.
The day before yesterday he wrote that if I didn't give him my word that I'd come, he would be obliged to put off his plan of going away and marrying me, and his father will take him with him to the young lady. And he wrote it so simply, so naturally, as if it were nothing at all. What if he really has gone to her, Vanya?
I did not answer. She squeezed my hand tight, and her eyes glittered.
He is with her,
she brought out, scarcely audibly.
He hoped I would not come here, so that he might go to her, and say afterwards that he was in the right, that he told me beforehand I wouldn't, and I didn't. He's tired of me, so he stays away. Oh, my God, I'm mad. Why, he told me himself last time that I wearied him. What am I waiting for?
Here he is, I cried, suddenly catching sight of him on the embankment in the distance. Natasha started, uttered a shriek, gazed intently at Alyosha's approaching figure, and suddenly, dropping my hand, rushed to meet him. He, too, quickened his pace, and in a minute she was in his arms. There was scarcely anyone in the street but ourselves. They kissed each other, laughed. Natasha laughed and cried both together, as though they were meeting after an endless separation. The color rushed into her pale cheeks. She was like one possessed. Alyosha noticed me, and at once came up to me. Chapter 9. I looked at him eagerly, although I had seen him many times before that minute. I looked into his eyes, as though his expression might explain all that bewildered me, might explain how this boy could enthrall her, could arouse in her love so frantic that it made her forget her very first duty and sacrifice, all that had been till that moment most holy to her. The prince took both my hands and pressed them warmly, and the look in his eyes, gentle and candid, penetrated to my heart. I felt that I might be mistaken in my conclusions about him, if only from the fact that he was my enemy. Yes, I was not fond of him, and I'm sorry to say I never could care for him, and was perhaps alone among his acquaintances in this. I could not get over my dislike of many things in him, even of his elegant appearance, perhaps, indeed, because it was too elegant. Afterwards I recognized that I had been prejudiced in my judgment. He was tall, slender, and graceful. His face was rather long and always pale. He had fair hair, large, soft, dreamy blue eyes, in which there were occasional flashes of the most spontaneous, childish gaiety. The full crimson lips of his small, exquisitely modelled mouth almost always had a grave expression, and this gave a peculiarly unexpected and fascinating charm to the smile which suddenly appeared on them, and was so naive and candid that, whatever mood one was in, one felt instantly tempted to respond to it with a similar smile. He dressed not over fashionably, but always elegantly. It was evident that this elegance cost him no effort whatever, that it was innate in him. It is true that he had some unpleasant traits, some of the bad habits characteristic of aristocratic society, frivolity, self-complacency, and polite insolence. But he was so candid and simple at heart that he was the first to blame himself for these defects, to regret them and mock at them. I fancy that this boy could never tell a lie even in jest, or if he did tell one, it would be with no suspicion of its being wrong. Even egoism in him was rather attractive, just perhaps because it was open and not concealed. There was nothing reserved about him. He was weak, confiding, and faint-hearted. He had no will whatever. To deceive or injure him would have been as sinful and cruel as deceiving and injuring a child. He was too simple for his age and had scarcely any notion of real life, though, indeed, I believe he would not have any at 40. Men like him are destined never to grow up. I fancy that hardly any man could have disliked him. He was as affectionate as a child. Natasha had spoken truly. He might have been guilty of an evil action if driven to it by some strong influence, but if he had recognized the result of the action afterwards, I believe he would have died of regret. Natasha instinctively felt that she would have mastery and dominion over him, that he would even be her victim. She had had a foretaste of the joys of loving passionately and torturing the man that she loved simply because she loved him, and that was why, perhaps, she was in haste to be the first to sacrifice herself. But his eyes, too, were bright with love, and he looked at her rapturously. She looked at me triumphantly. At that instant she forgot everything, her parents and her leave-taking and her suspicions. She was happy.
"Vanya," she cried, "I've been unfair to him, and I'm not worthy of him. I thought you weren't coming, Alyosha. Forget my evil thoughts, Vanya. I'll atone for it,"
she added, looking at him with infinite love. He smiled, kissed her hand, and still keeping his hold of her hand, turned to me and said,
"Don't blame me either. I've been wanting to embrace you as a brother for ever so long. She has told me so much about you. We've somehow not made friends or got on together till now. Let us be friends, and forgive us,"
he added, flushing slightly and speaking in an undertone, but with such a charming smile that I could not help responding to his greeting with my whole heart.
"Yes, yes, Alyosha,"
Natasha chimed in.
"He's on our side. He's a brother to us. He has forgiven us already, and without him we shall not be happy. I've told you already. Ah, we're cruel children, Alyosha. But we will live all three together. Vanya,"
she went on, and her lips began to quiver,
"you'll go back home now to them. You have such a true heart that though they won't forgive me, yet when they see that you've forgiven me, it may soften them a little. Tell them everything, everything, in your own words, from your heart. Find the right words. Stand up for me. Save me. Explain to them all the reasons as you understand it. You know, Vanya, I might not have brought myself to it if you hadn't happened to be with me today. You are my salvation. I rested all my hopes on you at once, for I felt that you would know how to tell them, so that at least the first awfulness would be easier for them. Oh, my God, my God! Tell them from me, Vanya, that I know I can never be forgiven now. If they forgive me, God won't forgive, but that if they curse me, I shall always bless them and pray for them to the end of my life. My whole heart is with them. Oh, why can't we all be happy? Why, why? My God, what have I done?"
she cried out suddenly, as though realizing, and trembling all over with horror, she hid her face in her hands. Alyosha put his arm round her and held her close to him without speaking. Several minutes of silence followed. "And you could demand such a sacrifice?" I cried, looking at him reproachfully.
"Don't blame me," he repeated. "I assure you that all this misery, terrible as it is only for the moment. I'm perfectly certain of it. We only need to have the courage to bear this moment. She said the very same to me herself. You know that what's at the bottom of it all is family pride, these quite foolish squabbles, some stupid lawsuits. But I've been thinking about it for a long while. I assure you, all this must be put a stop to. We shall all come together again, and then we shall be perfectly happy, and the old people will be reconciled when they see us. Who knows, perhaps our marriage will be the first step to their reconciliation. I think, in fact, it's bound to be so. What do you think?"
"You speak of your marriage. When is the wedding to be?" I asked, glancing at Natasha.
"Tomorrow, or the day after. The day after tomorrow at the latest. That's settled. I don't know much about it myself yet, you see. And in fact, I've not made any arrangements. I thought that perhaps Natasha wouldn't come today. Besides, my father insisted on taking me to see my betrothed today. You know they're making a match for me, as Natasha told you. But I won't consent. So you see, I couldn't make any definite arrangements. But anyway, we shall be married the day after tomorrow. I think so, at least, for I don't see how else it can be. Tomorrow we'll set off on the road to Pskov. I have a school friend, a very nice fellow, living in the country not far off in that direction. You must meet him. There's a priest in the village there, though I don't know whether there is or not. I ought to have made inquiries, but I've not had time. But all that's of no consequence, really. What matters is to keep the chief thing in view. One might get a priest from a neighbouring village. What do you think? I suppose there are neighbouring villages. It's a pity that I haven't had time to write a line. I ought to have warned them we were coming. My friend may not be at home now, perhaps. But that's no matter. So long as there's determination, everything will be settled of itself, won't it? And meanwhile, till tomorrow or the day after, she will be here with me. I have taken a flat on purpose, where we shall live when we come back. I can't go on living with my father, can I? You'll come and see us. I've made it so nice. My school friends will come and see us. We'll have evenings.
I looked at him in perplexity and distress. Natasha's eyes besought me to be kind and not to judge him harshly. She listened to his talk with a sort of mournful smile, and at the same time she seemed to be admiring him as one admires a charming, merry child, listening to its sweet but senseless prattle. I looked at her reproachfully. I was unbearably miserable. "But your father?" I asked. "Are you so perfectly certain he'll forgive you?"
"He must," he replied. "What else is there left for him to do? Of course, he may curse me at first. In fact, I'm sure he will. He's like that, and so strict with me. He may even take some proceedings against me, have recourse to his parental authority, in fact. But that's not serious, you know. He loves me beyond anything. He'll be angry and then forgive us. Then everyone will be reconciled, and we shall all be happy. Her father, too."
"And what if he doesn't forgive you? Have you thought of that?"
"He's sure to forgive us, though perhaps not at once. But what then? I'll show him that I have character. He's always scolding me for not having character, for being feather-headed. He shall see now whether I'm feather-headed. To be a married man is a serious thing. I shan't be a boy then. I mean, I shall be just like other people. That is, other married men. I shall live by my own work. Natasha says that's ever so much better than living at other people's expense, as we all do. If you only knew what a lot of fine things she says to me. I should never have thought of it myself. I've not been brought up like that. I haven't been properly educated. It's true, I know it myself. I'm feather-headed and scarcely fit for anything. But do you know, a wonderful idea occurred to me the day before yesterday. I'll tell you now, though it's hardly the moment, for Natasha too must hear, and you'll give me your advice. You know, I want to write stories and send them to the magazines, just as you do. You'll help me with the editors, won't you? I've been reckoning upon you, and I lay awake all last night thinking of a novel, just as an experiment. And you know, it might turn out a charming thing. I took the subject from a comedy of Scribes, but I'll tell you it afterwards. The great thing is, they would pay for it. You see, they pay you."
I could not help smiling.
"You laugh,"
he said, smiling in response.
"But I say,"
he added with incredible simplicity,
"don't think I'm quite as bad as I seem. I'm really awfully observant, you'll see that. Why shouldn't I try? It might come to something, but I dare say you're right. Of course, I know nothing of real life. That's what Natasha tells me, and indeed everyone says so. I should be a queer sort of writer. You may laugh, you may laugh. You'll set me right. You'll be doing it for her sake, and you love her. I tell you the truth. I'm not good enough for her. I feel that. It's a great grief to me, and I don't know why she's so fond of me. But I feel I'd give my life for her. I've really never been afraid of anything before, but at this moment I feel frightened. What is it we're doing? Heavens, is it possible that when a man's absolutely set upon his duty, he shouldn't have the brains and the courage to do it? You must help us, anyway. You're our friend. You're the only friend left us. What can I do alone? Forgive me for reckoning on you like this. I think of you as such a noble man, and far superior to me. But I shall improve, believe me, and be worthy of you both."
At this point, he pressed my hand again, and his fine eyes were full of warm and sincere feeling. He held out his hand to me so confidingly, had such faith in my being his friend.
"She will help me to improve,"
he went on.
"But don't think anything very bad of me. Don't be too grieved about us. I have great hopes, in spite of everything, and on the financial side, we've no need to trouble. If my novel doesn't succeed, To tell the truth, I thought this morning that the novel is a silly idea, and I only talked about it to hear your opinion. I could, if the worst comes to the worst, give music lessons. You didn't know I was good at music. I'm not ashamed to live by work like that. I have quite the new ideas about that. Besides, I've a lot of valuable knick-knacks, things for the toilet. What do we want with them? I'll sell them. And you know, we can live for ever so long on that. And if the worst comes to the worst, I can even take a post in some department. My father would really be glad. He's always at me to go into the service, but I always make out I'm not well. But I believe my name is put down for something. But when he sees that marriage has done me good and made me steady, and that I've really gone into the service, he'll be delighted and forgive me.
But, Alexei Petrovitch, have you thought what a terrible to-do there'll be now between your father and hers? What will it be like in her home this evening, do you suppose? And I motioned towards Natasha, who had turned deadly pale at my words. I was merciless.
Yes, yes, you're right. It's awful,
he answered.
I've thought about it already and grieved over it. But what can we do? You're right. If only her parents will forgive us. And how I love them. If you only knew. They've been like a father and mother to me, and this is how I repay them. Ah, these quarrels, these lawsuits. You can't imagine how unpleasant all that is now. And what are they quarrelling about? We all love one another so, and yet we're quarrelling. If only they'd be reconciled and make an end of it. That's what I'd do in their place. I feel frightened at what you say. Natasha, it's awful what we're doing, you and I. I said that before. You insisted on it yourself. But listen, Ivan Petrovitch, perhaps it will be for the best, don't you think? They'll be reconciled, you know, in the end. We shall reconcile them. That is so, there's no doubt of it. They can't hold out against our love. Let them curse us. We shall love them all the same, and they can't hold out. You don't know what a kind heart my father has sometimes. He only looks ferocious, but at other times he's most reasonable. If you only knew how gently he talked to me today, persuading me. And I'm going against him today, and that makes me very sad. It's all these stupid prejudices. It's simple madness. Why, if he were to take a good look at her, and were to spend only half an hour with her, he would sanction everything at once.
Alyosha looked tenderly and passionately at Natasha.
I fancied 1,000 times, with delight, he went on, babbling, how he will love her as soon as he gets to know her, and how she'll astonish everyone. Why, they've never seen a girl like her. My father is convinced that she is simply a schemer. It's my duty to vindicate her honour, and I shall do it. Ah, Natasha, everyone loves you, everyone. Nobody could help loving you,
he added rapturously.
Though I'm not nearly good enough for you, still you must love me, Natasha, and I, you know me. And do we need much to make us happy? No, I do believe that this evening is bound to bring us all happiness, peace, and harmony. Blessed be this evening. Isn't it so, Natasha? But what's the matter? But my goodness, what's the matter?
She was pale as death. All the while Alyosha rambled on, she was looking intently at him, but her eyes grew dimmer and more fixed, and her face turned whiter and whiter. I fancied at last that she had sunk into a stupor and did not hear him. Alyosha's exclamation seemed to rouse her. She came to herself, looked round her, and suddenly rushed to me. Quickly, as though in haste and anxious to hide it from Alyosha, she took a letter out of her pocket and gave it to me. It was a letter to her father and mother, and had been written overnight. As she gave it me, she looked intently at me, as though she could not take her eyes off me. There was a look of despair in them. I shall never forget that terrible look. I was overcome by horror, too. I saw that only now she realized all the awfulness of what she was doing. She struggled to say something, began to speak, and suddenly fell fainting. I was just in time to catch her. Alyosha turned pale with alarm. He rubbed her temples, kissed her hands and her lips. In 2 minutes she came to herself. The cab in which Alyosha had come was standing not far off. He called it. When she was in the cab, Natasha clutched my hand frantically, and a hot tear scalded my fingers. The cab started. I stood a long while watching it. All my happiness was ruined from that moment, and my life was broken in half. I felt that poignantly. I walked slowly back to my old friends. I did not know what to say to them, how I should go into them. My thoughts were numb. My legs were giving way beneath me. And that's the story of my happiness. So my love was over and ended. I will now take up my story where I left it. Chapter 10. 5 days after Smith's death, I moved into his lodging. All that day I felt insufferably sad. The weather was cold and gloomy. The wet snow kept falling, interspersed with rain. Only towards evening the sun peeped out, and a stray sunbeam, probably from curiosity, glanced into my room. I had begun to regret having moved here. Though the room was large, it was so low-pitched, so begrimed with soot, so musty, and so unpleasantly empty in spite of some little furniture. I thought then that I should certainly ruin what health I had left in that room. And so it came to pass, indeed. All that morning I had been busy with my papers, sorting and arranging them. For want of a portfolio, I had packed them in a pillowcase. They were all crumpled and mixed up. Then I sat down to write. I was still working at my long novel then, but I could not settle down to it. My mind was full of other things. I threw down my pen and sat by the window. It got dark, and I felt more and more depressed. Painful thoughts of all kinds beset me. I kept fancying that I should die at last in Petersburg. Spring was at hand. I believe I might recover, I thought, if I could get out of this shell into the light of day, into the fields and woods. It was so long since I had seen them. I remember, too, it came into my mind how nice it would be if by some magic, some enchantment, I could forget everything that had happened in the last few years. Forget everything, refresh my mind, and begin again with new energy. In those days I still dreamed of that, and hoped for a renewal of life. Better go into an asylum, I thought, to get one's brain turned upside down and rearranged anew, and then be cured again. I still had a thirst for life and a faith in it, but I remember even then I laughed. What should I have to do after the madhouse? Write novels again? So I brooded despondently, and meanwhile time was passing, night had come on. That evening I had promised to see Natasha. I had had a letter from her the evening before, earnestly begging me to go and see her. I jumped up and began getting ready. I had an overwhelming desire to get out of my room, even into the rain and the sleet. As it got darker, my room seemed to grow larger and larger, as though the walls were retreating. I began to fancy that every night I should see Smith at once in every corner. He would sit and stare at me as he had at Adam Ivanich in the restaurant, and Azorka would lie at his feet. At that instant I had an adventure which made a great impression upon me. I must frankly admit, however, that, either owing to the derangement of my nerves, or my new impressions in my new lodgings, or my recent melancholy, I gradually began at dusk to sink into that condition which is so common with me now at night in my illness, and which I call mysterious horror. It is a most oppressive, agonizing state of terror of something which I don't know how to define, and something passing all understanding and outside the natural order of things, which yet may take shape this very minute, as though in mockery of all the conclusions of reason, come to me and stand before me as an undeniable fact, hideous, horrible, and relentless. This fear usually becomes more and more acute, in spite of all the protests of reason. So much so that although the mind sometimes is of exceptional clarity at such moments, it loses all power of resistance. It is unheeded, it becomes useless, and this inward division intensifies the agony of suspense. It seems to me something like the anguish of people who are afraid of the dead. But in my distress, the indefiniteness of the apprehension makes my suffering even more acute. I remember I was standing with my back to the door and taking my hat from the table, when suddenly, at that very instant, the thought struck me that when I turned round, I should inevitably see Smith. At first, he would softly open the door, would stand in the doorway and look round the room, then, looking down, would come slowly towards me, would stand facing me, fix his lustreless eyes upon me, and suddenly laugh in my face, a long, toothless, noiseless chuckle. And his whole body would shake with laughter, and go on shaking a long time. The vision of all this suddenly formed an extraordinarily vivid and distinct picture in my mind, and at the same time I was suddenly seized by the fullest, the most absolute conviction that all this would infallibly, inevitably come to pass, that it was already happening, only I hadn't seen it because I was standing with my back to the door, and that just at that very instant perhaps the door was opening. I looked round quickly, and the door actually was opening, softly, noiselessly, just as I had imagined it a minute before. I cried out. For a long time no one appeared, as though the door had opened of itself. All at once I saw in the doorway a strange figure, whose eyes, as far as I could make out in the dark, were scrutinizing me obstinately and intently. A shiver ran over all my limbs. To my intense horror, I saw that it was a child, a little girl. And if it had been Smith himself, he would not have frightened me perhaps so much as this strange and unexpected apparition of an unknown child in my room at such an hour and at such a moment. I have mentioned already that the door opened as slowly and noiselessly as though she were afraid to come in. Standing in the doorway, she gazed at me in a perplexity that was almost stupefaction. At last, softly and slowly, she advanced two steps into the room and stood before me, still without uttering a word. I examined her more closely. She was a girl of 12 or 13, short, thin, and as pale as though she had just had some terrible illness, and this pallor showed up vividly her great shining black eyes. With her left hand she held a tattered old shawl, and with it covered her chest, which was still shivering with the chill of evening. Her whole dress might be described as rags and tatters. Her thick black hair was matted and uncombed. We stood so for 2 minutes, staring at one another.
"Where's Grandfather?"
she asked at last in a husky, hardly audible voice, as though there was something wrong with her throat or chest. All my mysterious panic was dispersed at this question. It was an inquiry for Smith. Traces of him had unexpectedly turned up. "Your grandfather?" "But he's dead," I said suddenly, being taken unawares by her question, and I immediately regretted my abruptness. For a moment she stood still in the same position, then she suddenly began trembling all over, so violently that it seemed as though she were going to be overcome by some sort of dangerous, nervous fit. I tried to support her so that she did not fall. In a few minutes she was better, and I saw that she was making an unnatural effort to control her emotion before me.
Forgive me, girl. Forgive me, my child," I said. "I told you so abruptly, and who knows, perhaps it's a mistake. Poor little thing. Who is it you're looking for? The old man who lived here?"
"Yes,"
she articulated with an effort, looking anxiously at me.
"His name was Smith, was it?" I asked.
"Yes."
Yes, then he is dead. Only don't grieve, my dear. Why haven't you been here? Where have you come from now? He was buried yesterday. He died suddenly. So you're his granddaughter?"
The child made no answer to my rapid and incoherent questions. She turned in silence and went quietly out of the room. I was so astonished that I did not try to stop her or question her further. She stopped short in the doorway and, half turning, asked me,
"Is Azorka dead too?"
"Yes, Azorka's dead too," I answered, and her question struck me as strange. It seemed as though she felt sure that Azorka must have died with the old man. Hearing my answer, the girl went noiselessly out of the room and carefully closed the door after her. A minute later I ran after her, horribly vexed with myself for having let her go. She went out so quickly that I did not hear her open the outer door onto the stairs. "She hasn't gone down the stairs yet," I thought, and I stood still to listen. But all was still, and there was no sound of footsteps. All I heard was the slam of a door on the ground floor, and then all was still again. I went hurriedly downstairs. The staircase went from my flat in a spiral from the 5th story down to the 4th. From the 4th it went straight. It was a black, dirty staircase, always dark, such as one commonly finds in huge blocks let out in tiny flats. At that moment it was quite dark. Feeling my way down to the 4th story, I stood still, and I suddenly had a feeling that there was someone in the passage here, hiding from me. I began groping with my hands. The girl was there, right in the corner, and with her face turned to the wall, was crying softly and inaudibly.
"Listen, what are you afraid of?"
I began.
"I frightened you so. I'm so sorry. Your grandfather spoke of you when he was dying. His last words were of you. I've got some books. No doubt they're yours. What's your name? Where do you live?" "He spoke of Sixth Street."
But I did not finish. She uttered a cry of terror as though at my knowing where she lived, pushed me away with her tiny, bony little hand, and ran downstairs. I followed her. I could still hear her footsteps below. Suddenly they ceased. When I ran out into the street, she was not to be seen. Running as far as Voznesensky Prospect, I realized that all my efforts were in vain. She had vanished. Most likely she hid from me somewhere, I thought, on her way downstairs. Chapter 11. But I had hardly stepped out on the muddy, wet pavement of the prospect when I ran against a passer-by who was hastening somewhere with his head down, apparently lost in thought. To my intense amazement, I recognized my old friend Ichmenyev. It was an evening of unexpected meetings for me. I knew that the old man had been taken seriously unwell 3 days before, and here I was meeting him in such wet weather in the street. Moreover, it had never been his habit to go out in the evening, and since Natasha had gone away, that is, for the last 6 months, he had become a regular stay-at-home. He seemed to be exceptionally delighted to see me, like a man who has at last found a friend with whom he can talk over his ideas. He seized my hand, pressed it warmly, and without asking where I was going, drew me along with him. He was upset about something, jerky and hurried in his manner. Where had he been going, I wondered. It would have been tactless to question him. He had become terribly suspicious and sometimes detected some offensive hint, some insult in the simplest inquiry or remark. I looked at him stealthily. His face showed signs of illness. He had grown much thinner of late. His chin showed a week's growth of beard. His hair, which had turned quite grey, hung down in disorder under his crushed hat, and lay in long, straggling tails on the collar of his shabby old greatcoat. I had noticed before that at some moments he seemed, as it were, forgetful, forgot, for instance, that he was not alone in the room, and would talk to himself, gesticulating with his hands. It was painful to look at him.
"Well, Vanya, well,"
he began,
"where are you going? I've come out, my boy, you see. Business. Are you quite well?"
"Are you quite well?" I answered. "You were ill only the other day, and here you are out." The old man seemed not to hear what I said, and made no answer. "How is Anna Andreevna?"
"She's quite well, quite well. Though she's rather poorly, too. She's rather depressed. She was speaking of you, wondering why you hadn't been. Were you coming to see us now, Vanya, or not? Maybe I'm keeping you, hindering you from something,"
he asked suddenly, looking at me distrustfully and suspiciously. The sensitive old man had become so touchy and irritable that if I had answered him now that I wasn't going to see them, he would certainly have been wounded and have parted from me coldly. I hastened to say that I was on my way to look in on Anna Andreevna, though I knew I was already late and might not have time to see Natasha at all.
"That's all right,"
said the old man, completely pacified by my answer.
"That's all right."
And he suddenly sank into silence and pondered, as though he had left something unsaid.
"Yes, that's all right,"
he repeated mechanically 5 minutes later, as though coming to himself after a long reverie.
"You know, Vanya, you've always been like a son to us. God has not blessed us with a son, but he has sent us you. That's what I've always thought. And my wife the same, yes. And you've always been tender and respectful to us, like a grateful son. God will bless you for it, Vanya, as we two old people bless and love you. Yes."
His voice quavered. He paused a moment.
"Well, well, you haven't been ill, have you? Why have you not been to see us for so long?"
I told him the whole incident of Smith, apologizing for having let Smith's affairs keep me, telling him that I had, besides, been almost ill, and that with all this on my hands it was a long way to go to Vasilyevsky Island. They lived there then. I was almost blurting out that I had nevertheless made time to see Natasha, but stopped myself in time. My account of Smith interested my old friend very much. He listened more attentively. Hearing that my new lodging was damp, perhaps even worse than my old one, and that the rent was 6 rubles a month, he grew positively heated. He had become altogether excitable and impatient. No one but Anna Andreevna could soothe him at such moments, and even she was not always successful.
This is what comes of your literature, Vanya. It's brought you to a garret, and it will bring you to the graveyard. I said so at the time. I foretold it. Is B still writing reviews?
No, he died of consumption. I told you so before, I believe.
Dead, Yes, yes, that's just what one would expect. Has he left anything to his wife and children? You told me he had a wife, didn't you? What do such people marry for?
No, he's left nothing, I answered.
Well, just as I thought.
He cried, with as much warmth as though the matter closely and intimately concerned him, as though the deceased B had been his brother.
Nothing, nothing, you may be sure. And you know, Vanya, I had a presentiment he'd end like that, at the time when you used to be always singing his praises. Do you remember? It's easy to say left nothing. He's won fame. Even supposing it's lasting fame, it doesn't mean bread and butter. I always had a foreboding about you, too, Vanya, my boy. Though I praised you, I always had misgivings. So, he's dead. Yes, and he well might be. It's a nice way we live here, and a nice place. Look at it.
And with a rapid, unconscious movement of his hand, he pointed to the foggy vista of the street, lighted up by the street lamps dimly twinkling in the damp mist, to the dirty houses, to the wet and shining flags of the pavement, to the cross, sullen, drenched figures that passed by, to all this picture, hemmed in by the dome of the Petersburg sky, black as though smudged with Indian ink. We had by now come out into the square. Before us in the darkness stood the monument,